kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. Joining as usual, Cole. How are you doing?
I didn't die between the last show and this one, so I guess I'm all right.
Progress.
It's a low bar these days.
Very low bar. That is what we are known for. SML, we are known for our low bars. And we constantly fail to get over them. Joining us, it is a party cast. We got Purnell and Chris here. How are you two doing?
It's kind of funny that she made that statement about that, because not even 10 minutes ago, I just typed to a person, getting through a day in and of itself is a major accomplishment. Celebrate that shit. So there you go. Very apropos. I'm doing all right. Snow kept me in the house, though.
Chris, how about you?
Oh, yeah.
I don't like going last because I...
There we go.
When I go last, like, I can't think of anything more depressing than what the other two have said.
Hey, first of all, what I said was not depressing. It is an accomplishment. Why would you not celebrate succeeding throughout, succeeding, making it through another day?
I know. Oh. I'm just saying, it's a dour sentiment.
I find it amazing because I tend to think of myself as, like, overly optimistic to a point that it's disgusting. And then you're like, no, you have the most depressing intros. Get the fuck out of here.
Okay, you know what? Here's a happy-go-lucky one for you. I don't know what it is about today, but I've been up buying one of those giant bags of, like, Jelly Belly jelly beans. And I got really nostalgic when I ate one today for a grade school thing where my fifth and sixth grade art class teacher, she would make the kids clean up all their desk spaces before leaving. Yet, whoever got it done first was rewarded with a single Jelly Belly bean. One bean! One bean!
How powerful a motivator was it?
Planted in the ground?
you would think, but no, we ate that shit, and we busted our asses to win it.
Of course you ate that shit. You win a jelly bean, you're going to eat the jelly bean.
That's right. And we were excited to get it. It was the best thing. And for like a good 2 years, I had no idea where she got them from. I just knew she had a jelly bean that tasted like a marshmallow, and I had to have it. And I worked hard to get it every class. And sometimes the bully kids would try to take your bean from me. And then you got to beat the crap out of them because you can't have my damn bean. This is mine. And I worked for it. You know, so, you know, like, honestly, I think about that now. Can you imagine a kid in grade school in the present being told, here's your one Jelly Belly bean. Thank you for doing a good job. Like, guess my ass, teacher.
So, we have a guest with us this week.
Have y'all ever had those jelly beans that have, like some of them have, like, sweet flavors, but some of them, like they have, like, some of them will taste like vomit or earwax, but you never know which ones they are. Imagine if the teacher had those.
Oh, that's like
you get a jelly bean. Good booger. How do you know what booger tastes like?
Hey, I'm not saying, you know, they're not my words, it's theirs.
The speculation.
Spend all that time cleaning out your desk, take a jelly bean only to find out that it tastes exactly like your dirty desk.
Like, I wanted to be thematic.
Maybe that's where the jelly beans were actually coming from.
Ugh.
What's the name of the flavor? Rusty Nail.
The jelly bean destino to just leave them.
Lead paint.
it was the 80s, so I guess
asbestos flavored. Yay.
We have a
guest joining us this week, game developer Adam Smith. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm trying to introduce you. We're doing a horrible job of it. But jelly beans. All right.
I don't mind just chilling and talking.
Yeah, I give him some credit, though. He rolled right with it. He was like, you know what? They won't shut up. I'm jumping in there.
I watched my fair share of Joe Rogan. I know how these things play out.
Yeah, sometimes you just got to jump in and Purnell will shut up eventually. But
Hey. If it ain't me, it'll be Cole. We'll be mouthy.
I resemble this remark. I do not like it. Who do I report this to?
Unfortunately, Joe is HR, so you're kind of screwed.
Hold on. Let me put my hair up so I can ask to speak to a manager.
Oh, God.
That's weird. That's okay.
I am the manager.
It doesn't work. I'm not blonde, so it doesn't work the same.
Got the, like, straight hair curved all over to one side.
Yeah, my hair is curly and red, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, you're no Karen.
Oh, man. So, Adam, how are you? You're here to talk about your game Lost Caves, just launched on Steam. For the people who don't know what Lost Caves is, give us the sales pitch.
So yeah, Lost Caves is a collectathon all about treasure hunting and exploration. You control Michael Miner, who, after a journey deep into a mine in the California desert, finds some gold on the wall. Tries to dig it out, and the entire mine collapses all around him, and he falls deep into a hole into the earth, finding himself in a large underground complex of caverns. These complex of caverns turns out to house an ancient civilization, and where there's ancient civilizations, there's treasure. So while trying to find a way out, Michael doesn't want to leave himself empty-handed, so the game's all about exploring your way through four different caverns with treasure scattered around every corner. There is, I believe, 87 different unique treasures for you to pick up, each with different wealth amounts to them, and the more wealth that you accumulate, the further you can progress.
For now, how much treasure did you get?
Well, I gotta say, I didn't get all the treasure, but I did complete go through every door. And
did you get to the boss?
I did, and I'm just gonna throw this out there right now. That is some masochistic shit right there. But I beat him. But it is masochistic.
Oh, well, beat her.
I guess it does make sense. She does like lay a bunch of the mole buggers, but
she is
like,
the queen.
But I did beat that boss, and I did receive what I won't spoil for anybody who plays to the point and gets to it as well. But I earned the thing that you get for beating her, and I was like, "All right, time for the second part of the game. Let's see what I can do with this new thingy." And it was like, "Game over." No, because to put in perspective for you. Joe offered me the code, and I put it in the PC just to be like, I'm going to boot this up just to make sure there's no issues with it running or whatever. And I played through the whole game. Like, I booted up to check it and ended up finishing it. So,
it's one of those games where you just lose yourself in it.
What I think about is like short. Yes. However, if it was just short, I still wouldn't have completed it in that one sitting. I completed it because I was hooked. It reminded me very much of like a sort of Commodore 64 type game. What's like, as far as the music goes and the like. And it drew me right the heck in. And of course, the idea of like getting unique treasures from chests by finding them with jumping and a pickaxe. I could just keep going down that road, but you get the point. Doing that is actually a surprisingly addictive measure. Like, it felt good to be like, I got this new thing. And yeah, it's like you get like a cool like blurb of text, and you get the image of what you acquired every time you get something. And as you mentioned in your descriptive, the purpose of the money is to further find your way into other areas of the ruins, because each door has a gold cap that was required to get inside. But despite breaking and exceeding that cap to get to the next room, I still was like, nope, gotta keep looking, gotta keep hunting.
And
I'm sure you know why I couldn't stop. I know you understand why I couldn't stop, don't you? I hope you do, because you designed the game.
Having unique treasures was, something I wanted to do for a long time. And actually, the whole unique treasure, because, again, just to reiterate to those who don't know, every single treasure in the entire game is unique. It has its own description and everything, its own image. Some of them are a little bit similar, but for the most part, everything is unique. Initially, it wasn't like that. A lot of that time, you'd get, repeat objects. But I knew at some point I wanted to have everything be unique because... just like in your case, it's a powerful motivator. Everything has its own little blurb of text, a little lore with it. So you kind of want to figure out what the next thing is.
There was one more reason, though. You are right about that, because every time I got a treasure, I didn't look it up and see, what is this? What is it about? What's the description? But the other thing that you slapped in there, which just kind of just nods at you if you don't do it right, is at the entrance to every ruin, there's a statue with a treasure chest on it and a little gauge that goes up akin to a thermometer. Yep. And the more treasure you get, the higher the gauge goes. So if you're like, well, my treasure color modifier changed, time to leave. You're walking out the door, like, wait a minute. There's that gauge has more mercury to fill in. I can get more mercury.
It's only halfway.
In.
What the hell? I'm bad at this.
Oh, no, not bad. It's more like, that's only halfway. Time to go back. I got work to do. You don't leave until you mine the place out. That's the rule.
Exactly.
And that honestly makes a world of difference. It basically pointed and laughed at you to say, if you leave without this thing being maxed out, what are you even doing here?
Yeah, aren't you
a man of treasure?
They'll just stay there laughing at you, taunting you.
Exactly.
Like, I've had people that'll spend like hours in some of these levels, especially like the third and fourth one, which are massive. And they'll be spending like hours going all over the place, finding treasures and stuff. I was honestly shocked seeing how much time people spent in this game. Cause I mean, it's, you know, based on my playthroughs and some of the beta testers playthroughs, it's only about, I think it's maybe 2-3 hours. I've seen people on Steam that have like 7 hours logged into this game.
Really?
And it blows my mind.
Holy cow. And it does add a bit of an inquiry though. Like, how long would you say it took you, not so much to program it, but to map the areas out? And I ask that because, kind of like you said, the first area seems like kind of like, you know, normal size for like this type of game. You know, like you play Spelunky, you've seen this size of a stage. And then you get to the second level and it's like, wow, this is a pretty big environment. Like, I'm still here. What's going on?
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of, it's actually almost a weakness of mine that I have a tendency to make very large levels, and it doesn't even apply to just this. Like, I play a lot of Super Mario Maker 2 on my Switch, and even those levels that I make in that game get, like, way too big, because I'm always, and especially, like, you know, in Lost Caves, you know, you got all these branching paths, and when I'm designing it, I don't really have, like, a master plan of everything. I may have a general idea of what I want to do, but I'll make a long, like, tunnel, I'll have a branch come out of it, I'll be like, oh, what if I did this? Oh, but, you know, maybe I'll make this other branch, you can go around it and do this, and what if I put some treasure over there, and I just, you know, I keep doing that, and eventually I've got this, like, you know, 10,000 square foot level. That's actually pretty small, but Michael, the player you play as, is also kind of small, so I guess that's actually pretty big. But I tend to go pretty overboard on these levels, and I was worried maybe it would be a little bit overwhelming for some players, but I mean, so far everyone seems to love it.
Overwhelming my ass. The real question is, I want more.
Yeah, I mean,
that's not a question, Pernell.
Lock in, phrase your question in the form of an answer.
I plan to add more content to the game though over time. This first part of the game is kind of like the first chapter. I'm planning to release it episodically, kind of like I believe Deltarune. I believe it's kind of released in the same manner. So after this, I'm going to be working on the next chapter, hoping I can do that a little bit quicker than the first chapter, because the first this game took about a little more than three years to develop. I'm hoping the next major chapter will be a little bit take a little bit less time, and I imagine it will. You know, I've got to, you know, the reason this first chapter took so long is because, you know, I was developing the whole player, you know, how everything worked, the physics. I got all that pretty much nailed down, so everything else is pretty much just more level, more enemies, more puzzles and stuff. So I think I can knock that out pretty quickly, and I'm looking forward to it.
So I got to know, 3 years of your life, the levels are massive, hours of playtime put into this. How are you only selling this for $1?
So I'll do one better. I was initially going to give this for free. Because, oh, wow. I was, you know, I mean, I already work a full-time job. I didn't really need the money, but, I mean, people at the same time, like, you know, I started to, eventually late in development, I started to actually put money into the game. Like, I paid for a Unity license, which is like $40 a month. I bought Adobe Creative Suite. That's another $40 a month. Had to pay to put this on Steam. That's $100. It all adds up, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm putting a lot of money into this. And after getting some advice from some people, I decided to charge just a little bit of money for it. You know, I mean, I'm just a small indie developer. You know, a lot of people may overlook me. So maybe if I make it a little cheap, some people may turn the other way and give it a shot. But after people have been playing it and checking it out, I've had it the game played on a couple of streams, actually. And everyone's always like, man, you're selling this for only 99 cents. Like, that's the price of a McDonald's McDouble. You know, you should be charging more for this. So with that in mind, I actually am I'm planning to raise the price this Friday up to $3.99. So the first week is it's 99 cents to be a kind of an early adopter reward to the people that have supported the game over the years and to the first few people that that come across it. But after that, it'll go up to $3.99. And
still, $3.99 is really good for this game.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go too much higher. I feel like a lot of games, they'll charge it for like $10.99 for like a 3-hour game, and I don't know, it just seems like too much to me. I feel like $3.99 is at the perfect spot for me, but then right when I add more content and put in a significant update, I'll up the price up another $3 or $4 in slowly, you know, the price will accumulate over time. But people who got the game before the price will get all that stuff for free.
That's really awesome. Are you going to be releasing them as updates, free updates to the game, or are you looking into DLC or Lost Caves 2?
So they'll all be free updates. So if you bought the game now, when that update comes around, you'll have that for free. But if you haven't bought that game, the price will go up another, you know, a few dollars. Maybe it'll be, you know, $8 or so when that update comes out. And so you'll have to pay for that. But if you had it already, you won't have to worry about it. You'll get that free content.
That's really cool. That is an awesome way to handle things, and more developers should do that.
Yeah, I mean, I like getting money for it, but I do really care a lot more about just people playing the game and enjoying it. I've actually been checking pretty frequently, like online, like on YouTube and stuff, seeing if people have played it and have made videos on it. And I was a little bit surprised. I checked on YouTube this morning, and I found like four Let's Plays of it. And they're all like really small YouTubers, you know, nothing big, but it was just kind of cool that people liked the game enough to actually want to make a video of it.
So, well, I mean, it hits a number of good notes, though. Like, first thing, it's got the retro vibe, which it does hook a lot of people. Two, it's got a level of challenge to it that doesn't require you to, like, sit down and try to break the game. It's just playing it with the limited move set, but you have to play well with that move set. And yep. Then, of course, you have a fantastic OST, because the music, I think, is really good. And then lastly, it's just the general vibe of exploration. One more chest, you know, one more coin, you know, one more jerkbag bouncing asshole statue, you know, the essentials. But I think you pretty much nail all a number of notes that make you want to sit down and just keep playing this game.
Yeah, I'm glad everyone seems to think that. I mean, it motivates me even more to want to make more content of it, because I'm not going to lie, when I was developing this and getting it up onto the getting to the beta testing phase, I was actually pretty nervous about the kind of level design and sort of gameplay loop that I had established, because the last time people had played it fully was back in 2019, and I only had, you know, the first and second level fully completed. And that was a really short experience and kind of bite-sized. But now, you know, you're doing this kind of treasure collection and exploring for like much longer. And I was worried people would get a little bit burnt out, but it seems to be the complete opposite. And you're a testament to that. You know, you people just seem to want more.
Yeah, it's always just finding more stuff. Like it's the go-to. I mean, think about it. Going all the way back to like N64 or even some Super Nintendo games, the idea of being like, okay, this level has X number of gobbledygooks, got to collect those. But there's also 100 hidden Machuckle Buckles, got to find those. But under that bridge, there's a McGoinkle Goinkle, which doesn't do anything for me, but I still want it because it's hidden.
You got to have it. It's like all those Cornell, you have a way with words. The wild.
They're great words, you know. But like, yeah. I am curious. Like, what? Like, I guess I have two questions. The first one should be probably an easier one to answer. Is the dog associated with you in some way?
You mean the dog statue, the little the shrine?
Yes.
Yes. It's actually it's a tribute to our friendly dog. Isabella was her name. She passed away almost about a year ago. I felt like it was a way to honor her. I added it to my game, and the treasure you get, actually, the little hex ball, it was actually meant to represent her favorite toy. So I just felt like it was a nice way to honor, you know, game design, development. It's my bread and butter, so just seemed appropriate.
Appropriate it was, because I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. What if there's a story behind it? And lo and behold, there is a story behind
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
That is awesome. Then
the second question, and the more literal one, what inspired you to make this game?
So, Lost Caves actually dates all the way back to 2011. I was playing a lot of Kirby games at that time, and I was particularly playing Kirby Superstar Ultra, the DS version of Kirby Superstar. So those who don't know, Kirby Superstar and Superstar Ultra is kind of like a compilation game. It has a lot of smaller, bite-sized games inside of it that can be, you know, between 5 to 10 minutes in length to a couple hours. One of those games is called The Great Cave Offensive, mm-hmm. where Kirby is going off on an adventure. He falls into a hole in the ground and wakes up in this large complex of caverns. Pretty much the exact same premise that Lost Caves has. Although I guess it's vice versa, actually, because my game came afterwards. but the whole goal of the game in Great Cave Offensive is to return to the surface, but there's also a treasure all over the place. So your secondary goal is to also accumulate as much wealth as you can by finding treasure scattered around. In Great Cave Offensive, though, the treasure is actually completely optional. You could leave you could play through the entire game without picking up a single chest.
But ain't nobody doing that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you got to get all that satisfaction. And so I kind of wanted to make a game all about that. It went through a couple of different phases. I was thinking about making Lost Caves, you know, maybe like a roguelike. I made a prototype of it back in 2014. I played around with a lot of different ideas. But I didn't really start developing it until 2017 for a class in college. But it initially takes inspiration from Great Cave Offensive, but I also incorporate a lot of different things in there, particularly Super Mario 64, because Super Mario 64 is a collectathon with collecting power stars and a bunch of different levels. You've got that hub room. Lost Caves follows a pretty much the exact same formula as that, just in two dimensions. And aesthetically wise, it also takes inspiration from Cave Story with the kind of limited color palette and small, cute characters. In fact, the character you play as in Lost Caves, Michael Miner is his name. He actually resembles a quote from Cave Story a little bit.
Okay.
But a lot of also different small stuff here and there that takes inspiration from, but those are kind of the big three.
Well, I think I'm glad that's what your inspiration, because you name everything you named there is pretty much quality. You didn't make any comments like, you know, I was playing, you know, Leisure Suit Larry, you know, the bad one, the other day, and it just inspired me to make a game, you know.
Yeah. What really is really cool to see, though, is that whenever someone talks about my game, they never actually think that it never reminds them of sometimes it reminds them of Cave Story, but it never reminds them of the other two games like Great Cave Offensive or Super Mario 64. Every single person seems to have like a different game that it reminds them of. People have said Pitfall 2, Commander Keen, Spelunky, obviously, DuckTales, Shovel Knight. Everyone seems to have like a different game that it reminds them of, and it's kind of cool seeing that. And I can also take inspiration from those games and apply that to later content.
Well, you know how it goes when it comes to games. Like, people have, like, even if someone has played The Great Cave Offensive, what ends up happening is usually people have specific games that fall at the top of their list and want to stand out the most just from sheer love of the product. So the moment something strikes that fancy, they don't look for anything else. They're like, it hits the game I want to talk about. Yeah. It reminds me of that. Yeah. So, Like, you might get that one guy, he's playing, like, you don't remind me of NHL 96. You
know, yeah, just, exactly.
I see it. So, but honestly, it's all good in the end, because if you get a game, if your game makes people feel nostalgic and whistle for good games, not trash games, you are doing something right. Just
yeah, by absolutely. Default. And I tried to achieve that because, of course, you know, pixel art platformers are really all over the place. You don't really need to look hard for that. But a lot of them don't really, I think, achieve that kind of true retro aesthetic. They really only kind of use pixels because it's easy. So in my case, I actually try to heavily limit my color palette. Lost Caves has a limit of, I believe, 128 different colors, most of which aren't even used, because a lot of those colors I have are actually kind of garbage and don't really fit the color palette anyways. But I really try to limit the color count that I have. And I think it kind of helps give a sort of mixture of 8-bit and 16-bit aesthetics and give that sort of 1980s, 1990s nostalgia.
Cole, what are your thoughts on the visuals? I know you're a big stickler for pixel art.
Well, it's not that I don't like pixel art personally, but I think it's just...
It has been done to death.
It's because I see so fucking much of it.
Yeah. And most of it isn't really that good. I mean, you know, some people do a good job with it, but some of the games that I see that use pixel art, like I look at it, and I mean, they don't look bad, but I'm just like, why did you need to use pixel art for this? Like, I don't know if you all have played Rogue Legacy before.
Yes.
But Rogue Legacy... yeah, I love that game. And the visuals look good, but it seems like the pixel art, it doesn't really match. It doesn't really seem to belong. And it looks like even the developers themselves know that, because if you play, I haven't played it yet, but I've looked at bits of Rogue Legacy 2, and it doesn't use pixel art at all. And I think they went a good direction for that. But I think one of the reasons is because while it's... While you know you do have big fat pixels, they don't really limit the color palette, so it really just kind of feels like low resolution modern graphics, which is fine, you know, it's not bad, you know, but it doesn't truly give that old, you know, 1980s, 1990s vibe.
Yeah, and I can see like a lot of people. Sometimes it's like it can be a combination of like if it's easy. Or sometimes it also could be just like, it could be just like a cash grab idea too. Like, people love nostalgia, throw some pixels on it, spread it out with a little bit of beep bloop, and it'll make some money.
Nowadays, every developer and their mother does it. So,
yeah.
Some people kind of want something a little different. And late in development, like when I was marketing this game, I was kind of beating myself over the head because, I mean, you know, I'm trying to, you know, when I'm contacting press, a lot of, just like it goes with most developers, you know, a lot of people overlook me or I don't get a response. And I felt like one big part of it was because, you know, my game just looks like another pixel platformer. And so being able to kind of brand it as something that isn't, or that something that's more than just that, was really tough. But I think it has, managed to pay off. And I think, people kind of see it as more than just, you know, ye old pixel platformer.
Ye old.
Even if that is a little bit what it is.
I can appreciate that you're just like, yeah, it's a pixel platformer. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. And Joe likes to call me on it whenever it comes up, especially if we're talking to somebody who made a pixel game, because yeah. He likes to put me on the spot because he's a cunt.
I am. I very much am.
And it's Joe. Like, I don't necessarily hate that games are pixel art, but we see so much of it, and so yeah. Rarely is it good.
Exactly.
That it often feels like it's a cop-out for like, hey, I didn't know how to do any other kind of art. Thankfully, I don't get that vibe when it comes to Lost Caves. I don't feel like it was just a cop-out. Like, you were like, I didn't know what to do, so I did pixel art. It was like, no, it feels like it fits what you wanted for the game.
Absolutely. And, I mean, there's also not a lot of pixel platformers that have the same formula that that Lost Caves has. You know, a lot of those games you see today are usually very, very linear in their kind of in their level design. You know, you go from point A to point B, or in, you know, Metroidvanias. And I'm, for the record, I'm not dissing on these games. You know, I love games like Shovel Knight, Axiom Verge. Those are great games, but they are pretty much, you know, go to point A to point B, or in, you know, again, in Metroidvanias, you've got point A to point A-1 so that you can get this part, so you can fight this boss, so you can get this upgrade to access this area. It feels open world, but it's really not. So Lost Caves tries to offer a more refreshing experience by offering a more, I guess, sort of relaxed experience where you can kind of explore at your own pace until you get to particularly challenging parts like the final boss.
Yeah, but I got to ask, you said you've had people play this game and they gave you feedback. How many people said screw you when they fought the final boss?
If you think the boss was hard, is already hard, you should have seen it back when I was in beta testing. Because if you played it back then, it would have destroyed you. It was way harder. The rocks that would fall would be way more. The fire rate, when the boss shoots the fireballs at you, it was way more often. It was it took more like hits to damage your shell. It was way harder. I nerfed the heck out of her. If you think it's hard now, you should have seen what it was last time.
So now I'm going to ask, were you able to beat the boss before you nerfed it?
Oh yeah, of course. You know, it was hard. You know, it frustrated me a couple of times, but I was able to beat it. But since I was able to beat it and I was able to get the hang of it, I wasn't able to really tell how difficult it really was. And now that you know, people gave me feedback on it, I was like, oh crap, this thing really is a kind of a handful, to put it lightly. So I had to nerf it quite a bit. But there, I don't know if it happened to you at all, but there, I have gotten feedback where, have you ever tried hitting it with the cannon and sometimes the boulder that hits it would just bounce off and it wouldn't actually hit it, even though you know you hit it?
Yeah, but at the time I just kind of assumed that there was like a sweet spot in the face and then a sweet spot in the chest. I mean, if I was hitting, like, say, in the neck area, it was just like, nah, you didn't hit it where you needed to. It doesn't matter.
I think that was actually a glitch. I thought I fixed it. But after release, someone told me that, like, they hit it like 7 times during one of the fights, and it wouldn't register as a hit.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I can definitely tell you it didn't happen to me 7 times, and I fought him quite a few times before I got it right. The only thing that happened to me,
that person was just having bad luck.
I will say the only thing that happened to me, though it wasn't like a game breaker, which is like that one time I was like, damn, was one time I fired the rock out of the cannon, it bounced back, you know, hits the ground, and you're like, okay, because I'd missed him, and it hits the ground, I was like, okay, I gotta reload the cannon, so I'm like trying to hit the ball back over, and somehow I hit it in a way that I got stuck between the wall and one of the blocks that was appearing where you need to kind of scale up, because, like, you know, the first phase, they don't flash in and out, they're just solid. It somehow got stuck
in
a solid block in the wall. I was like, but how the hell did that happen?
So, oh, like, man. Is that, you know, I thought I fixed that. Were you able to get it out, or did you have to restart the fight?
I don't know. I've died so many times that it just all overlaps, really. Let's just say a wizard did it, and I fought
him. All right.
A wizard did it.
But I still got through. I beat him, and I feel proud because,
props to you. Yeah.
It was brutal.
Chris, did you want to chime in at all? We haven't heard from you yet.
Oh, I was.
Are you playing it?
No, I'm not.
Like, I'm buying.
I only have one monitor, so I can't play computer games while on the chat.
One monitor? Oh, you're missing
Windows
out.
Mode.
Well, it's a small desk.
Fair enough.
Speaking of, is Lost Cage getting a windowed mode?
It does have a windowed mode, actually. I haven't. I tried adding something into the onto the options menu, but I had a really hard time getting it to work. But I believe if you press Alt Enter,
yep,
it will actually bring it into windowed mode.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I do that for that multiple games because I don't know games. Like, I figured that out for one game one day, and I was like, oh, that's how all games work, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much.
You can tell I don't PC game much.
No, I don't. Okay, so actually, it's funny because, you know, Purnell was talking about how the game reminds him of, like, a Commodore 64 game. I was actually thinking more like Amiga, only because, like, a lot of the music had the instruments panned hard left and right. Although, not all of them, but I was like, I'm hearing drums only in the left ear, so that means this is an Amiga game.
Yeah, so a lot of the, so the music comes from a few different sources. So I did write some of it. I did write the main theme that you hear in the title screen, and the music that you hear when you go into the pyramid. That's called the Ruins theme, along with the hub music and the boss theme. But the music that you hear in the levels, like in the levels 1 through 4, those are all composed by a good friend of mine named I don't actually know her real name. I've only known her on the internet, but she goes by Ardbei, Ardbei, and she's a fantastic chiptune. And so when I started development of the game, I actually reached out to them and asked, "Hey, could I use some of your music for my game?" And they were like totally on board with it. And so I kept using it, and I mean, everyone seems to think it's a total banger. So I just couldn't drop it. So I'm actually in talks with her about getting the rights to the music and everything. Some of the music was also the pre-boss level music was actually made by someone named I think his name was Matthew something. I hope he's not listening to this podcast right now. And
it's okay. No one listens to this podcast.
Well, somebody may listen. He's in the credits.
Someone may listen. Someone paid attention to our show.
Yeah. But he did the pre-boss music. He did a fantastic job with that too.
I do hope that you get it licensed and then, you know, like kind of packaged together and sell an OST separately, because that's what I like to even if, on games I review, I like to invest in the OSTs if they're available.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm planning on putting each of the tracks up on my YouTube channel, so that you know, until I get an actual OST album set up, if I do that, people can at least jam out to the music on my YouTube.
Heck yeah. That'll work for my purposes.
Yeah.
I intend to.
So thank you. Out to it while studying or coding or something.
Or while raiding a lost cave.
Or that, exactly.
Well, my thing is I run an obscure music appreciation group on Facebook. It has about 3,000 members in it. And all we do is post obscure music links from YouTube. So
what's some of the stuff that you've shared?
Oh geez, I'd have to like check it. Weird,
kind of like, I don't even know what I could think of. I've heard of some really weird stuff though.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's well, let's see. We got Stellar Assault on the Saturn. Somebody posted Hades. I'm like, okay,
that's obscure. Yeah, there's a lot of Final Fantasy that gets posted in that group.
Yeah, we don't gatekeep. In the group, we always say use your own judgment. So people sometimes are like, "Oh, Final Fantasy VII Remake is obscure. Maybe I'll post 10 tracks."
You know, maybe there's like that one track that everyone seems to overlook in the game.
Yeah, you know, after so many years, it's like we don't even care anymore.
I do have to say that, speaking of Final Fantasy, I don't know if any of y'all played Game Boy Advance remake of Final Fantasy I, Dawn of Souls.
But the
music in that is an absolute banger. I love it. The battle theme, the final boss theme.
Yeah, the chaos theme that they added.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all fantastic.
Yeah,
And I'll sometimes jam out to that, too.
Yeah,
I think never played that one. So now you got me thinking, did I miss out on a hit?
It's a fantastic game. It's actually the only Final Fantasy game that I've actually played, because I'm usually not a really crazy RPG person, because I always find that they're really bloated with mechanics, and I usually don't like spending hours trying to figure out how to play a game. But Final Fantasy I's, you know, really simple, you know, turn-based role-playing game, nothing really fancy. So I got really hooked on it when I first tried it.
Yeah, I love the original Final Fantasy. It's actually top 3 or 4 for me.
I've only played the Game Boy Advance version. I haven't played the NES one.
Oh, that's okay. I have nostalgia for the NES one, but yeah, I beat the Game Boy Advance version too, and it's a very worthy remake.
Absolutely.
Oh, somebody posted one yesterday that got everybody's attention, and I don't know how to pronounce. I think this is either Polish or Swedish, but it's Harald Hardtand, which stands for Harold Hardtooth. It's a DOS game, and it came out on like Amiga and some other computers things back in the day. And it's a game made by Colgate, where
what?
You play as a tooth.
Oh, no wonder it's Hardtooth.
Yeah, you play as a tooth, and you and your job is to clean other teeth. It's just a game about brushing your teeth. And I'm gonna drop a link into chat and stuff, because everybody that should listen to it, because it has this funk title theme that absolutely slaps. And somebody posted that yesterday, and everybody was in shock because nobody had heard of this before. So
are you dropping it in the Twitch chat or in the Skype chat?
Both.
Anyway. Oh, nice. Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to take a listen to it. It kind of, even though it's probably a completely different game, it just kind of reminds me of Chex Quest, you know, just kind of a game made for the sole purpose. yeah, exactly. Although I'm not going to lie, I could totally see a game about brushing your teeth, someone making like a Doom mod of that too. Like you're armed with this tube of toothpaste, and you shoot all these teeth coming after you, and instead of them exploding with blood everywhere, they just turn into really exactly. Or you know, you'll just have dirty teeth coming at you, but you blast them with the BFT big effing tube, and just turn them into nice clean teeth.
And you know what's funny, there actually is a second game about cleaning teeth. Rex Ronan, Experimental Surgeon on the Super Nintendo. That one's a little less obscure now.
Yeah, that sounds like such a
how's the soundtrack game in that, Chris?
Brushing your teeth.
My microphone almost unplugged. Nice. The soundtrack's pretty average on that one, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I was originally going to ask if we could get some Lost Caves music to play on the show, because we play music at the end of the show, but now I'm wondering if I should just play that Hard Tooth song instead.
I mean, go for it.
If you want to do that, that's cool, but I can also send you the, I can drop a link in the Skype chat for RB's SoundCloud, and you can play some of the tracks on there. I believe three of the tracks from Lost Caves are on that, so let me go ahead and find that. They all have some very interesting names on them too. So RB composed both the two level themes from level 1 and levels 2 through 3, and they also made the music for the mini boss. That one is probably my favorite, which is the boss music, which is called Famitracker Pizza. So it was made, of course, on Famitracker, which is an NES music DRM that abides by all the limitations.
Which also makes a great pizza.
Yeah, you know, maybe. Let me go ahead and
Dark
find Meek that,
in chat. Why does he fucking know about teeth brushing games?
I'm a man of many useless talents.
I'd be shocked if he didn't.
Another question from chat that we have to address, that we have to always ask this. Do you have any console plans for the game, like Xbox, possibly? Because we are an Xbox-heavy show. We got to ask.
So I've consoles is definitely something I'm thinking about. I'm actually leaning more towards, I'm sorry to say, but I'm actually leaning more towards the Nintendo Switch, because that's got a really big indie scene on it. But it's not something I'm like dead set on doing right now. I kind of want to build the audience on PC first, because I want to make sure there's actually enough of a demand for it on Switch before I, or any console for that matter, before I start porting it, because porting stuff to consoles is expensive. I mean, I don't know how much it is for PS4, PS5, or the Xbox One, or the Series X, but like Nintendo Switch, to get a dev kit for them is $400, and that's on the cheap side. And that's not, you know, talking about all the other expenses that I'd probably have to go through just to get that on there. So it's not going to be quite something I'm going to think about doing until there's enough of an audience for it. I may put it on on mobile devices though pretty soon. I got
thrown on Stadia.
Oh, I'm going to be honest with you. I could not care less about Stadia, and I don't think I don't think anyone is going to want to play. Because I mean, the only reason you're getting Stadia is if you know you've got like a little potato PC that can't handle playing a game like Cyberpunk 2077. You know, Lost Caves can run on any machine. I've got this.
I have a potato PC, and I don't have a Stadia. So I mean, hey.
Well, yeah, but Lost Caves can run fine on that, so you don't need Stadia for it. You know, I have this old like laptop, this Lenovo laptop from like 2010. I use it mostly for running Linux, but I can run Lost Caves on that no problem. I don't think anyone's ever going to need Stadia for my game, and Stadia is already a dying. It seems like a dying platform. They just recently they stopped making like content exclusive for it.
They killed their first party studios just this week.
Exactly. So I mean, I don't see it. I don't see Lost Caves getting on there at all. if we're gonna be honest. So sorry to break it to you, but consoles like, you know, like home consoles and mobile devices is definitely something I'm thinking about, but. I'm only really going to do it if there's an audience for it. But
I can tell you now one good way to create an audience on Xbox.
Oh, well, I guess what? Talking to you all?
Well, that's not going
to
work.
No, we're not going to get you an audience at all. No one's going to listen to this.
Oh, yeah, no, you also audience. Have a decent amount of viewers, you know.
Do you want to hear the trick?
Yeah.
Easy achievements.
Easy
gamer score whores will gobble you up.
Who?
Gamer score whores.
Oh, gamer score whores. Is that because of like, I don't know, I don't play a whole lot of Xbox. How does like is achievement hunting like a really big thing on there?
Oh yes, very much so. Every game gets 1,000 achievement points, more if you have DLC or expansions. And if you can get an easy 1,000 in a game, people will drop, you know, $5-6 easy for your game if you could complete it in a half hour. It's
wow.
Weird, yeah. But you know, there's some publishers who their games, they focus on releasing, they'll release full games, but the achievements are just directed at like the first quarter of the game.
Oh, wow. So people will like spend 90% of the time in that one section.
Yeah. So if there's a game with 100 stages, it'll be like there will be achievements to beat like through level 20. And then you've completed all the achievements.
Oh, gravity. Oh,
yeah, I'm planning to. I mean, just like, you know, I'm planning to do kind of the same thing with Lost Caves. I mean, I try not to do. I try not to put achievements in every little corner, but I try to put enough there to kind of give another incentive to explore. Like, did any of you all ever did any of you all have ever completed it and got like sort of the post game item? Like, our Pernell, did you ever go to that secret area on the far right of level 4, the one that kind of requires a leap of faith?
I did do that, but I didn't have that item at the time of doing so.
Oh, okay.
But the leap of faith was definitely there.
Yeah, I figured people would try it, especially since there's a checkpoint right next to it. So, you know, they'll be like, you know, what the heck, you know, I'll see what happens.
YOLO.
They'll see that little ledge off on the far right as they plummet to their death, and they're like, oh my god, there's something there! But how do I get there?
The funny part is, like, me finding that, it wasn't from the plummet. It was like, I made the jump, I landed properly. It was like, if I'm thinking about the right zone, it was the, you know, the hot spot. I'll call it the lava rare area. And it's like, I landed, and there was, oh, yeah, no, never mind. I remember you're talking about the part where it's like, you go to the right, and the music kind of stops, and it's just like clearly an open space. Yeah, I jumped straight down, and like I think it's like you said, like I was falling down. I was like, well, I'm dead. I'm kind of dead. And I was like, wait a minute. There's a thing that we can do. So I was like, okay, well, I'll go back, and now I'm just going to hug the wall.
But there's more. Up on the, there's a, if you jump, you know, not to spoil it for you, but if you jump all the way over to the far right, even without the post-game item, you will see something there. And when you get the post-game item, you'll be able to access it. And there is a there's treasure there, but there's also a little something-something at the that's also there. That's there's no like treasure, but you do get an achievement for it. And it does offer a few kind of strange questions because you aren't really given a whole lot of context, which is actually kind of a, you know, treasure collection aside, that's also kind of a big thing with Lost Caves is a lot of games are really big in putting lore into their games, and I kind of try to do that, but I try not to be super upfront about it. I try to put a lot of stuff in the background, kind of makes the players you know, question what exactly happened to this civilization. Like, you know, I'm sure you saw the big pile of bones and the five statues on the thrones with one with the head missing.
I did. I tried. The funny part is that first I thought that was going to be like a clue for something. It's like,
nah, some people have seemed to think that, but there, I mean, there is something in, you know, later in the in that level that does relate to the missing head, but it's not particularly a clue, I guess.
Seems I'm going to go back to that area and try to make the leap.
Yeah, well, that's it's not related to the treasures, but there is something pretty, well, I think is pretty cool there. And as I add more content to it, you'll kind of get a better idea of what exactly it is. Right now it's just this kind of isolated little thing that I'll give more payoff in as I add more content.
Oh, and also worth noting, by the way, speaking of that area of the game and whatnot, I will say that I genuinely feel as though you did a good job of working with the dark spaces. Typically, when you play games like this, and a developer says, hey, you want to fumble around in the dark like a mook, it's a frustrating ordeal. But I honestly felt like it was appropriate. It was thematically appropriate for this game, because it's like, well, he's wearing a hard hat. The hard hat has a light on it. Oh, well, you know, it works. You know,
and I didn't want it to. I didn't want to have it there for very long either. Initially, I was actually going to have it so that the pyramid was going to be dark for most of the time you were in there, and the switch to turn the lights on would actually not be would actually be on the top of the pyramid instead of kind of at the bottom. But I think having it a little bit earlier on just kind of make it feel rewarding, and seeing everything kind of open up around you and seeing all the stuff you missed. It's a bit rewarding and a bit exciting.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah. By the way, I just dropped the music, or one of my RB's chiptune playlist. The two or the three tracks that they made that's in Lost Caves is Vortex Tracker 2 Test, Bama Tracker Pizza, and Colors. So if you feel like playing those at the end of the podcast, they're there for you.
Nice. We will include that link in the show notes as well, so people could hit that up and check them out.
Yeah, I mean, RB is super talented, so, you know, give them all your support, because they absolutely deserve it.
Sweet. Well, I know we've been chatting for quite a while. Is there anything anybody wanted to ask that we didn't touch on yet?
I think I just exploded. I blew his eardrums out, so I'm covered.
Chris, yeah, Cole, anything?
I think I'm good. I think we
I'm good.
Talked a heck of a lot about this game, and that's...
Yeah, I had a blast.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Awesome having you on. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we let you go?
I guess to those who are watching that have already bought the game, just stay tuned to follow me on Twitter. I post updates pretty regularly on there. I'm already going to be releasing a patch to the game at the end of the week that already addresses a couple of fixes from feedback that I've gotten from players. But I'll also be talking about you know, more content that I'll be adding on there. If you don't mind, actually, I don't mean to shamelessly plug myself. But
no, please do. Tell us where we could keep up to date with you, and tell us where we can follow you and all the information that we need.
Here, I'll drop my Twitter link onto the chat on here, and then you can post it onto the show notes. But my Twitter handle is ADScomics_. Apparently, some person took the one without it. I was a little upset to discover that.
What a dick.
But there, I usually post updates. I try to do it daily, but I do it at least regularly. And plus, I usually will post stuff up on the Steam page and announcements and stuff as well. And I'll also probably be starting up a Discord server for it as well, so that people who really enjoy the game can all kind of talk about it, you know, talk about different strategies and stuff. I didn't mention it actually, but this game has been around for only, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 days. I'm already kind of losing track. And people have already started to find speedrun strategies for it. There's a video out on YouTube of this guy who figured out how to do this super jump trick by using the post-game item. And you can use it to gain a lot of height and find some places that you're not really supposed to be going to. And I think it could it has some speedrun potential. And I'm kind of designing the game with that in mind, kind of trying to make it pro speedrunner. So I typically try not to patch out any glitches if it enriches the experience. And if I do, I'll probably add them back in like a speedrun mode or something. But you know, follow me on Twitter. I'll post updates on there. Whenever I make that Discord server, I'll mention it on there as well, as long as on the Steam page and then announcements. I think that's all I've got. My mouth is actually starting to get a little bit dry from talking so much.
Well, it has been awesome having you on the show. Again, the game is Lost Caves. It is on Steam right now. If you get it right now, you could get it for $1. It will be going up in price. You said $3.99.
Yep, it'll be going up to $3.99 on Friday.
So chop, get on that. I know Angerth said in chat that he bought it for a relative, and Carnage bought it for himself. So you made 2 sales doing the show.
Fantastic.
That's about as good as we could do for you.
Hey, some people who watch may not buy it now, but maybe they'll check it out. Maybe they'll buy it later. You know, every impression matters.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, do you have any final words before we let you go?
Nope. I think that's all I got. Thank you so much for having me on, Joe.
Was fun.
That was fun.
That was really fun. He's a good dude.
Yeah.
I would have to say.
Oh wait, he's not here. Let's shit talk him instead. What a son of a bitch.
Never.
He's gonna listen to the show and he'll be like, "Oh, they didn't like me." No, he was awesome. That was a fun chat. He was a cool dude. We'll have to get him back on again sometime. Maybe maybe I'll tell him to like hit up Rattlake Games.
Oh, for releasing, that's a good idea. They would totally publish that game.
That seems like a perfect fit for Rattlake.
That is exactly their MO, is the small 1 or 2 person game that's just getting started. Yeah.
and then throwing in the easy achievements.
Yeah.
Well, some of the games don't have easy achievements, so
that's true.
They could always take the achievement seriously with this one.
Yeah. And when it comes to this game, like if a game has basically achievements on Steam, do they ever rework the achievements for console releases? Because he already has them on this one.
A lot of times they just carry them over. Port the same achievement list rather than making a new one.
Well, I mean, even if he didn't change them, short of having an achievement for something like get every single treasure, I feel like many of the achievements can be acquired just from playing it like quickly. Because like I said, I beat the game in like maybe 3-4 hours, and I had a fair roster of them just from running around and finding, just looking for treasure, because that's what you do in Lost Caves. You get rich, baby.
Yeah, we'll talk more about our thoughts on the game later on in the show, because we have reviews to do. Should we dive into these? I know it's already been an hour. Should we get our asses hauling with some reviews?
Sure thing. Though, just warning you, after the first one, I might have to hit the WC myself, so just throw it out there.
Now, good thing that there's a gap for you,
between your first and second games.
No, we're giving you a break, so you could go Jacob.
Oh, are we poor Jacob? He's a good guy.
All right. First game to talk about tonight is called East 9 Monstrum Nox, developed by Nihon Falcom, published by NIS America, released February 2nd on PS4 for $59.99, coming to Switch and PC in the summer. While imprisoned in Baldug, Adol is cursed and becomes a monstrum. With his newfound powers, he must stop the Grimwald Nox from consuming the city. Brunel, tell us about East 9.
For anybody who just likes ease games, just going to say go buy it and just be done with it. For anybody else,
done and like, done.
Hi-oh! But for anybody else who's somehow in this day and age is still like, what the hell is ease? Well, the ease franchise is a series of games that chronicles the adventures of Adol Christian and throughout the course of his life, pretty much. And in the case of this particular game, it involves him taking a journey to a prison city, having a typical Adol moment, meaning that he gets thrown in prison just for whatever, and he has to make a daring escape, which in the process of making said escape, he gets injected with the Monstrum Curse, which allows him to become, I guess, like an alternate version of himself, which gives him special powers. Though I kind of chuckle at the thought of it, because if you play the NES game, most of his sword abilities that he gets through the end of the game are like crazy supernatural light thrusting stuff anyway. So the fact that he gets it from this is like, yes, yes, it's Adol, but now it's red. Whatever. So I was like, it's not particularly like a game shaker, though it's still pretty cool that it happens. And as he escapes the city, he finds himself in a predicament where, due to the curse, he is unable to leave the city. Like, he's trapped there. So the majority of the game, there are some elements that would let you go to like the outskirts and stuff, but for the most part, the game is spent inside the city limits of Baldur, and you're trying to figure out how to escape, how to get out, how to break the curse, and just general elements of what the hell's going on in this city. So the game, unlike some of the earlier Ease games, it's very chapter broken down. Like, they took a note from the Trails of Cold Steel games, and they decided to kind of break it up into sections of chapters. Like chapter one, it has a title. Chapter two has a title. And the best way to describe the point of these chapters is that in addition to Adol, there are five other Monstrum characters that exist in this town. You're introduced to them all fairly early, but you don't really know anything about them. You just know they are other Monstrum characters that are trapped here with you, stuck doing what you guys do. And what is it that you guys do exactly? And then after I say that, then I'll get to the chapter structure again. I apologize, but I should probably say it. As Monstrum, all the characters are at the beck and call of another person named Aprilis, who summons the characters into a place called the Monstrum Nox, or the Grimwald Nox, and they are made to fight monsters there to protect a crystal. Translation: shoehorning the tower defense elements from Ease 8 and throwing them in Ease 9. There you go. But that's what you're doing. And then when they're done, they get sent back to the real world of Baldur, and they have to just kind of hang out there and live their lives until it's time to go back. Each chapter of the game is essentially an element of you learning trying to get back into the prison to investigate. And in the process of that, you end up learning about one character from the Monstrum crew. And inevitably, they end up joining your party because, well, it's Adel. Who would resist his awesome charms? So the gameplay mechanics of the game, aside from the description of a chapter, is it's an action role-playing game. As you're running around the town, you know, you can talk to people, shop at stores, blah, blah, blah. But in addition to that, since you're stuck in the town, you might be asking yourself, well, if you're trapped in town, how do you end up fighting a lot of enemies? I mean, monsters, are they just running around this town? Yes, kind of are, because there are sort of mini portals to the Grimwald Nox littered about the town. And when you walk up on one, you kind of phase into the Grimwald Nox and monsters are all over the place. And time freezes essentially for everyone else. Like, it just, you're on the other side, more or less. So the town's standing still, the monsters are kicking the snot out of you, and you are fighting them using a series of special attacks linked to the R trigger button and then the face buttons that initiate them. And of course, your regular attack, which you'll almost never use, because why? You've got special moves. And then, of course, you can like do two things called a flash guard and a flash move. Flash move is if you dodge the last second of an attack, it lets you move a little faster than enemies for a few seconds and get some quick attacks in. Flash guard is blocking at the last second, and you get a boost to your burst gauge and some stronger attacks on the opponent. Where's the burst gauge? Max it out. Initiated by hitting the two trigger buttons, you go into a super powerful, I'm juiced up and I'm not ready to die mode, and you start beating the tar out of guys with increased damage, increased crit, and a bit more speedway. And the gauge for the boosting drains slowly. If you do the boost attack again before you completely run out, you do your ultimate Super Magella move and you beat this tar out of guys and you feel great about yourself. I guess, for people who've played Ease games, that all sounds very familiar, and it should, because that's all pretty much par for the course with Ease games as far as combat goes. They haven't really rewritten the formula much since Ease 7. But the thing that I would say that they did with this game that is a bit of a change compared to other games, two things. One, use of the Monstrum powers creates a large amount of exploration in this world. This is probably the most vertical Ease game you will ever play in your life. For example, the second move you get is called Heaven's Run. It allows you to just straight up run up buildings. Any building, any wall. You just run straight up until you run out of boost gauging. And that results in you going to the top of like skyscrapers, the top of churches, the top of like cathedrals. You're just up and about. And the third ability you get is like flight, which allows you to just kind of glide across places. So between the flight and the wall run, you can do damn near anything. If it weren't for the whole Grimwald Nox curse blocking you from certain sections of the city until you unlock them, you'd have free reign from like the third character of the game. So wackiness there. But it's honestly genuinely fun to run around and explore the city. I never grew tired of that. And lastly, the other element that they kind of added and changed a bit more is how they work with the questing system. So I mentioned earlier a reference like Trails of Cold Steel and how they work with the chapters. And that applies to the questing system, too. Quests in this game are initiated from a quest board, which tells you where to go to talk to a person. And if you talk to them, they tell you what to do, kill dudes, find items, blah, blah, blah. But some of the quests, also like in Trail of the Cold Steel, are hidden, which means they're not on the board. And you just kind of have to stumble across the person in town who's going to give it to you, which means you'll be talking to a lot of people. So if you care about hidden quests, look for green exclamation points above people's heads while you're running through town willy-nilly, because you might spot a guy. I won't ramble much more about the game because I could probably talk a fair bit more about it, but there's not but so much you need me to say. Just know that it is Ease 9, Monster. Oh, one last thing I do want to say. There are a lot of treats in this game for fans of the series that have been playing it for years. Like, it's not even a spoiler, it's just flat out stating what's really great is at the very beginning, when you get locked up in prison, you're interrogated, and the person starts running down like the eight-old bullet list. Like, how many times have you been shipwrecked? This is some crap. Who does this? And he's like, it's all real. I'm not making it up. It's like, it's just, they really ham it up about the fact that Adol goes on crazy adventures, gets cool weapons, and never has them in the next game. Like, it's just cool elements like that where I was like, this is really fucking awesome. There's cool boss throwbacks. There's dialogue throwbacks. It's just, if you've played the earlier games, you will smile a lot while you play this, because they clearly know their audience, and they're pretty much fan servicing it for us, and it's great. But yeah, for the most part, this game is fantastic. If there was any knock I could possibly give it, it's probably the fact that Ease 8 had you exploring a tropical island, which means there was a lot of room for like wacky, cool, beautiful discoveries. But Ease 9, you're in a drab prison town. So a lot of the dungeons are just like underground, like sewers and this, and buildings. So it's not going to make your eyes pop until you go to like more of the Grimwald Knox environments. But yeah, Overall, it's still a great freaking time. Like, I was not bored. It's a wonderful time. It gets a heavy recommendation from me. And I think if you buy it, you will not come away regretting it.
Cool. So your official verdict at $60?
Absolutely should buy this game.
Cool. Works for me. I'm looking forward to this hitting Switch in the summer. I'll probably pick it up on there.
That's what I bought it for, too. So I'm glad I got to review it, because I don't have to wait till the summer.
Wait. Yeah, Switch for me, I think, too.
Nice. Cole, what about you?
Eh.
What if I play Lori? Will you less met it?
Eh. You are never going to play Lori, so we're fine.
You just don't like anime chins.
Nope.
Oh, well, there it is. See, the truth comes out.
I am unapologetically biased against anime chins.
I don't want to get an interview with someone who draws anime chins.
Do it, and then I'll be like, why do you do this? That's not how anatomy works.
I gotta ask to confirm this. When you say anime chins, is this like a wacky slang term, or you're actually referring to the chins of anime
characters? The pointy ass chins of anime characters.
Christ.
The bitches, how do they even eat their food? They ain't got no jaws. Look, I'm so annoyed my accent's falling out.
Why is my jaw with such a horrible jawline?
I hate it so bad.
What is wrong with me?
Oh my god. Anyway, next game to talk about is called Citizens Unite Earth Cross Space, developed by Eden Industries, published by Kemco, released January 28th on the Switch and PS4 for $29.99. This time, the two adventurers have united with brand new elements, recruit 88 citizens with unique abilities to save Earth in both time periods. Time travel back and forth between citizens of Earth and citizens of space, unlocking new content and revealing the true ending. Unite the citizens to save the timeline from secretive foes operating behind the scenes. Chris, tell us about Citizens Unite.
Okay, well, as the text says, this is a an unusual thing, actually. It is a combining of two existing games where now they're linked together. And completing like both of them, or like completing a requirement in both of them, unlocks like additional content, including what they're calling the true ending. The only other thing I can think of that's like that were the Zelda Oracle games, the Oracle of Seasons and Ages, which both came out on the Game Boy Color at the same time. And then when you beat one, you got a code, and you beat the other, you got a code, and you like put them together or something like that, and then you got to play extra content. So it's kind of like that. So, but yeah, the games themselves are straight up RPGs, which actually I didn't know. I'd come across Citizens Unite a few times in like the eShop, and I always passed it over because, I mean, the art style to me, like on the Switch especially, just kind of look like shovelware because it's big, bold, cartoony characters. And, you know, with really goofy facial expressions. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be going to be an auto runner or like, you know, some other.
I'm really thing. Surprised I'm not- you never played these. I always thought these would be like right on your radar.
Yeah. No, that's the thing is that nobody told me about them. So I just kept coming across them in the eShop. And look, I shop through the entire eShop like at least twice a week, like the entire thing. So yeah, I've come across them many times and never even bothered to check them out. So this is my penance for that is that now I have played them. So yeah, what they are basically just RPGs. The first game has you playing as the vice president of the world. And the second game has you, and that's in kind of a modern day. It's a little 80s-ish, maybe 90s-ish. So he's not fashioned after any particular vice president, thank God. He's just a a very enthusiastic but kind of dumb politician type guy, very much like a Phil Hartman character, like on The Simpsons or something. Like, clearly the voice actor was going for like a Phil Hartman style, you know, voice. Yeah. And the second game is, you know, it takes place in space where you're the ambassador of Earth, whose mannerisms are so similar to the other character. They're basically the same character, all the way down to the voice. So I'm thinking that one is related to the other. I haven't come across like solid confirmation of that yet, but like there's hints here and there. So in both games, the similarities are that you go around the world, you know, you're basically like trying to save the Earth in different ways. In the first game, you're trying to save it from like kind of an alien invasion. And then the second one, you're actually trying to find it. The Earth is missing and you're up in space and you have to go find Earth. Nice. And figure out what happened to it. Yeah. And they, you know, what it kind of boils down to is like, of course, going around talking to everybody. And there's a massive recruiting system. So like anytime you talk to a character, like most of the characters in the game, honestly, you'll eventually come across a dialogue option to recruit them. And so you do, and hardly any of them will come with you initially. So you have to like do some kind of quest. It could be as simple as a fetch quest of like three items that are common. It could be something much more like one of the early characters in Citizens Unite Space requires that you clean up a space station by finding 200 different items laying around, which are, you know, they're shiny spots on the map, so you'll eventually just find them all, but like, yeah, I haven't done that yet for sure. But it's a janitor who is also a blob, so it's kind of funny. And that's the cool thing about it, is that in both games, like, because, you know, the one is Earth, and so it's modern, and so it's definitely a satire of, like, kind of general, kind of Americana, which might remind you of Earthbound, and we'll get back to that in a second. Like, in the first game, and by the way, I'm jumping between the two games for a very good reason that I'll reveal in a second, but in the first game, like, you're recruiting people like a journalist. Well, actually, your first two characters are your mother and your brother. And then you can go and recruit a photojournalist and a conspiracy theorist if you can find evidence of, like, aliens being behind people getting super addicted to Moonbucks, quote-unquote, which is a very addicting brand of coffee. You know, things like that. And of course, you can recruit a barista as well. And, you know, it's just like I said, all kinds of characters that you can do. And they're all different, but they all do kind of fall into like the kind of typical RPG roles. So, you know, there's not like any huge standouts, but it's really cool to like get a new character and like kind of figure out what they're all about. And so in the first game, the other thing is that, you know, you're like in the first area, you're fighting like protesters who are just kind of just protesting you. Like, they don't really seem to have any particular vendetta. They just really hate you. And so they fight you. But then you use your mother and your brother to take them down. And of course, you're a conspiracy theorist, your barrister, your photojournalist, whatever, you know, whoever's in your party, you can obviously, you know, choose. And each game has 44 people or four beings to recruit. So there's a lot of like, it's, you know, Suikoden levels of like, oh, who am I going to have in my party, you know, and mess around with. And so, yeah, the difference between them, like gameplay wise, is that the first game is much more, you know, by the way, if I don't know if I even specified that the first game is Earth and the second game is space. The first game, you're actually like playing it in like the battle system is very reminiscent of Earthbound and by extension Dragon Quest. It's, you know, behind the character's view and, you know, you just choose options and fight. By the way, your main character never fights. Your main character is the leader. So he just stands by and, you know, gives the command and then quips, of course, lots and lots and lots of quips. And then, you know, your actual team like does all the fighting. So the way it kind of works is that you have certain moves that will add a light, like there'll be three blank spaces, and then you know, a move might add a green light to it, and then a move might cost a green light. So you have to like keep using regular moves to save up those lights, so that you can use a stronger move that will consume them, and then just, you know, repeat, rinse and repeat. So that's actually kind of cool, because it keeps you from just, you know, in all of the moves are, you know, they don't cost anything except for that light that you get in the battle. So, and you can actually keep them between battles too. So, you know, if you want to fight an easier enemy and you just use regular moves to take them down, you can then use stronger moves to take down a stronger character or enemy later if you so choose. And so that's like in the first game. And in the second game, it's actually a little closer to the like Mario and Luigi games, or like Mario, what do you call it? What's the
Paper Mario?
Yeah, well, like, yeah, Paper Mario and the Mario and Luigi games, where you fight, and it's more like a side view at that point, like a Final Fantasy, but each character has a potential bonus attack or defense that is wrapped up in a micro mini game. So one character might require you to push the button real fast. One character might require a precise push of something, and you have to react like kind of WarioWare style to like what they're doing. And it doesn't wreck the system if you don't get it, because, you know, sometimes those can be challenging for people. It's just a way to get a bonus, really. And so that's really, I actually found the battle systems really fun to do. Like, I didn't tire out from the battles at all, like, you know, playing through this thing. And all the enemies are on the map, so if you choose to avoid them, they usually don't even chase you. So... but, you know, a lot of times an enemy will have a specific item that you might need to be collecting so that you can recruit somebody. So, like, in that way, the game is kind of pushing you towards fighting a bunch of battles. And, of course, you want to gain levels and money for new equipment and everything. But the game does not shove, you know, combat down your throat, which I really quite like. And then that brings us to the humor of the game, which is... I like to call this like the shotgun approach to video game humor, where every single thing, everything from flavor text to the voice acting to the dialogue, every bit of dialogue, it has to have some kind of joke in it. Now, the quality varies. You know, it's everything from actual clever jokes to just straight up puns to just alliteration, like, or, you know, just characters being sarcastic at each other. Like, the game tries everything on you, and it could get tiring to somebody who doesn't appreciate video game humor, but I think that there's enough hits in here where it's actually worth, like, you know, hanging out. And plus, the voice actors really sound like they're having a ball. It can get irritating at loud volumes, but, and, you know, and the chatter is like the incidental chatter is like not as bad as, well, I mean, I recently beat Xenoblade Chronicles, so I can tell you it's not as bad as that in terms of just random banter. but, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, characters being cartoony and saying things and yelling things and all this other stuff. So it's kind of over the top. It's very colorful and very fun. Both of them are. And yeah, so the bit that I was getting to is that in this game, this is something I haven't seen before in a game that's a combination of two existing games. It gives you the ability to switch between the games at any time just by pushing the minus button on the Switch. It will be like, you want to save this game and switch to the other? And you're like, yeah. And then it goes to the other game and you can just play that and then push the button again if you want to switch back. It doesn't matter. Like, apart from the fact that one takes place in the past and one takes place in the future, and they do have like certain little, you know, what do you like, time anomalies where they actually do combine a little bit, and that was added into this combination game. Apart from that, it's just like, you know, you just play one game and then play the other, and they both have separate timers, separate save slots, and, you know, I honestly have never seen that before, and I think it's actually really cool.
Also,
yeah, I expected shovelware, and I got my ass handed to me. This is a great game.
Well,
I do have to ask one question.
Go ahead.
What was that, Pernell?
I do want to ask you one question, because I was actually looking forward to this review, because I actually own both Citizens of Earth and Citizens of Space.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, and if you don't know, I totally understand, but do you think they added enough with this weird combination mechanic to make it worth buying it again if you've already owned the two separately?
See, yeah, I can't speak to that because this is the only one I played and I haven't gotten to the special ending yet. So I would say, and that kind of wraps up in that wraps into my what I think Joe's inevitable question was.
Yes, your verdict for $30.
So for $30, if you have not played either of these games and you don't own them yet, this is the way to go. So go ahead and get it. And it's definitely it's two full RPGs for $15 that, you know, like I said, you can wrap up and you know, play the end of. And like I said, it's the humor is good. The graphics are good. The battle system is like keeps you coming back. And, you know, it's not like the best game in the world. But I mean, what is that Kemco has published? But to Purnell's question, is it worth it if you already own the other two games? I don't know because I haven't seen the extra ending. But I will say that it seems like, you know, the parts where the games combine are very minimal. And so I wouldn't say that, like, that part would maybe make it a big sale. It really would have to come back to that extra content at the end of the games. And, yeah, I just can't speak to that. So I would say, yeah, buy it if you don't own the games already. Maybe a try it and do better research than I did if you already own them. But, you know, I also am definitely the kind of person who has spent about, I'd say, right, combined in all total, I've probably spent about $350 on the Toe Jam and Earl Back in the Groove game, purchasing it multiple times and also kickstarting it and also buying the limited run special edition of it. Ooh. So it's like, as somebody who has no compunctions about purchasing the same game many times, I would say if you liked owning them separately, then, you know, this is a cool way to experience them kind of like together.
Cool. I'm bummed it didn't release on Xbox, but that's because I'm guessing because Citizens of Earth isn't on Xbox, but Citizens of Space is.
That's so interesting.
If people want a taste of the franchise on Xbox, you can pick up Citizens of Space.
And what's the price of that on Xbox?
Oh God, I have no clue.
Okay. I don't know either. Like I said, I've really
I want to say 20, but I don't know for sure.
It's actually like, they're like full price games by themselves too.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense. Again,
you're getting two games for $30, though.
So. Yeah, yeah. So. Yeah, that makes sense to me now that I've played them. Like, again, I was like, just looking at the cartoony graphics on the Switch, I was like, I don't know.
See, don't judge a book by its cover, kids.
That's exactly the lesson what I today. Did. And I was wrong, so.
That'll teach you. Yeah. Next game is The Dark Eye, Chains of Sadanov, developed and published by Daedalic Entertainment, released January 27th on Xbox One, Switch, and PS4 for $19.99. Face your destiny in Andergast, whose inhabitants are considered to be notoriously superstitious. King Ephrodon awaits a state visit from high-ranking dignitaries. For centuries, the kingdom has been at odds with the neighboring Nostria, but now first steps are being undertaken towards a lasting peace. Cole, I know you talked about the other Dark Eye game on the last episode, and we believe this is the first of the two.
Yeah, the second game has made so much more sense to me the more I played through the first. I was like, I get it now. Okay. This is why I have that rule of like, I don't like to play shit out of order.
Yeah.
And I did it on accident here. And I spent the whole time with the second one going, I don't know why that matters. Now I know why that matters. So for Chains of Sadanov, you actually play the entire game as Jaren. I praise the writing for Memoria a lot based on how well they had wrote the additional female characters. And in Memoria, you actually swap back and forth and play some chapters as Jaren and some as Saja. You don't do that in Chains of Sadanov. It's just Jaren. And holy shit, do you realize what a bland motherfucking character he is? I did not realize how much, like, I know I was praising the female characters, but I didn't realize how much weight they were pulling in that game until I played without them in Chains of Sadanov. So basically the whole premise here is that Jaren is, he's a bird catcher. He was present at the execution of the seer when he was a child, and the seer, who was an evil prophet, prior to his death, warned the townsfolk about having Jaren around. So his whole life, he's been called bad luck. And to add insult to injury, he has a magic spell that he can literally only use it to break things. So it wasn't entirely wrong, at least initially. We fast forward a little bit. Jaren's story picks up with him trying to win a favor with the king, and or an audience with the king, and you know, his face is being pushed down into the pig trough while he's having it out with some of the locals. He's very clearly losing his fight. And it does make it very obvious that bad luck is kind of his forte. As the story progresses, you will solve puzzles. It's a point and click. It's not anything where you're like massively timed, or there's no urgency to it. No matter how much he's being drowned in the pig trough, there is never any urgency. You can play the game at your own pace. But you will solve the puzzles, progress the story. As things move on, you discover that Jaren's bad luck continues, and the person that he lives with, who has taught him how to be a birdcatcher and stuff, there's an event surrounding that person that leads Jaren on a path where he needs to go and find a fairy girl who is strong enough to play a magical harp to prevent the return of the seer. It's very weird, very much plays into that high fantasy. There are imps, there are orcs. It's what you would expect if you were told you were going to play a fantasy adventure, but with a point and click narrative. Apparently there's like an actual pen and paper style tabletop game based on this series, this world. And like the game, the point and click Daedalic games are like a spinoff of that. I had no idea.
Purnell, do you know anything about the Dark Eye being tabletop?
It is German.
No, I'm not. I told you what was going down. So I put the phone on mute, baby. But honestly, that doesn't ring a bell to me. But now I kind of want to look it up.
Yeah, I believe it's German. But it is a pen and paper tabletop game. And then this is basically a spinoff from that series. Anyway, yeah, you get to explore the world, try to get the fairy to the magic harp, while other shit is going down around you. And there are instances where Jaren has decisions to make. And I have learned that those have absolutely no bearing on the story whatsoever. And this is kind of one of my pet peeves, right up there. Not quite as high as anime chins, but it's up there. When I'm giving an option in a point-and-click narrative game like this, where I have decisions to make on how I'm going to approach something, I want to feel like those decisions affected the world a little bit. And both Chains of Satinev and Memoria did this, and they don't make a difference at all other than just which achievement pops for you. And it's like, you were so close. Even if it had just made a small change in the world's aesthetic or something, It would have made a difference, rather than it just being like a false sense of reward for, hey, you get to make a choice. Doesn't do anything, but you get to do it. That's a pet peeve of mine. I know a lot of people don't give a fuck. I will say, at least as far as the achievements go, you can save scum it, so it's not too bad. And then you can just get on both and carry on. And then it doesn't matter which save you choose, because it doesn't change anything anyway, no matter what you do. but at least there's that. But yeah, I really enjoy the story. I really enjoy the world. I feel a lot better about the story and the world as a whole now that I actually like can tie it together and understand what I was doing between the two games. I would definitely say to play them both. If I'm not mistaken, yeah, play them in order. Don't pull on me. But definitely play them both because they are a nice continuation. And I do think that Chains of Sad Enough helps set up Jaren's story a little better than if you're just like, while I think Memoria has the stronger characters and narrative, it is nice to have that follow through and at least understand some of Jaren's motivation a little more.
All right. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right, next up is Silver Chains, developed by Crackhead Games, published by Head Up, released January 29th on PS4 and Switch for $24.99. After a mysterious accident, Peter wakes up inside of an abandoned mansion located in rural England. Not knowing how or why he ended up here, he soon begins to realize that he's not alone. Peter tries to find his way out. He starts to uncover the dark secrets of what happened in this place. More disturbingly, he discovers hints indicating that he had been here before. Chris, what's going on in Silver Chains?
Well, for one, you don't wake up inside the mansion. There's this whole, like, you know, running from your crashed car into the mansion to be like, and I don't know why he chose to do that. Maybe to use the phone or something. I don't know.
Had to pee.
He kind of narrates the adventure as you go and stuff like that. So, you know, I don't remember if he ever said anything about why he's coming into the mansion besides feeling compelled. Okay, so this game is, well, for one, I got huge like flashbacks to Remothered, which I had reviewed some time ago, because like there's so many similarities, and I forgot to check whether these two had anything in common. Besides the fact that I think they're both inspired by Konami's PT, their ill-fated demo for a, I suppose it was going to be a Silent Hill game.
Yeah.
But it's that vibe for sure. It's walking around an extremely creepy and very, like, realistic-looking, like, mansion kind of thing as weird stuff starts happening and the game kind of plays with you before it throws jump scare after jump scare at you. This game actually, and you know, I'm not a horror aficionado.
I can hear Cole sobbing on the inside that this isn't on Xbox.
Yep. It hurt.
What was I saying? Oh yeah. Yeah. Like I'm not much of a horror aficionado, but, I do know that like, a lot of the ones that I've like reviewed and stuff were kind of light on the jump scares. Not this one. This one absolutely like will make you throw your headphones at certain points. but that's good. Like, you know, that's the kind of game this is. This is a haunted house type of situation. So the mechanics are basically, you know, you move around in first person mode. And of course, first thing I did was swap the Y-axis, because that will allow you to do that, which is great.
Yay.
And, I'm talking about Silver Chains, Dark Mika was asking.
And she should pay attention more.
Well, she did once I said Remothered. Anywho's. So, yeah, your thing is basically to walk around this house and try and figure out what's going on, because you start seeing ghosts and you start reading notes and you start seeing like bits of diary and things like that. And, you know, just things start happening, and your ever curious, compelled protagonist has to check it out. And basically, yeah, it's all about like I said, you know, you're walking around and like, you know, the room gets a bit weird. A lot of the ways this game plays with you is, for one, it looks amazing. Like, it, maybe not so much the actual characters on the screen. If you get too close to them, you know, they kind of do show a little bit of, you know, they don't have quite the gloss that like something that Konami or Capcom would have made would have, but that's okay. That's not a problem. The actual atmosphere of the room, like the lights coming in from the window with dust, like dancing in them, you know, like really little details and things like that. Like there's a shine to the background. And, you know, a filthiness, of course, because, I mean, you know, it's got the, it's honestly, it, even as a person who's not much into horror, like, I recognize a cliche when I see it. And, you know, you walk into a bathroom and the bathtub has something floating in it, but the water is really murky and dirty. So, you know, you got to go grab that thing because it's part of a clue that you need. And then what happens? But something grabs you, but then disappears. But, like, you know, describing it sounds goofy, but when it's actually happening, you're just like having a panic attack, you know. Like, and that's the other way that this game really works out is the sound design is great. This game is really good at doing like the quiet thing and then the loud thing, but like, you know, and using the score to basically underline jump scares and kind of be jump scares of their own. So like you hear knocks on the wall or footsteps or something like that, and it actually has the effect of, you know, of making you be like, oh no, what's that? And of course there's, you know, all these different narrow hallways and, you know, doors to open and things like that, and you don't know if the door is going to be locked or if it's going to open up and like something's gonna like kind of jump out at you or whatever. Because we're dealing with ghosts, a lot of them are harmless, except that eventually you do run into, and I won't say what it is, although you can actually see it on most of the game's advertising. It's a monster, essentially, that actually can kill you and does so in one hit. Like it's very hard to run away from. So the thing is to, you know, dive into a nearby closet, of which the game has many. Like, again, it's a haunted house like type thing, so it's like the actual layout of the house makes no sense except in the context of it being a video game. And they really make no apology of that, like the kind of like, because the way that you progress in the game and open up new areas and things like that is through puzzle solving. And the puzzles aren't so bad. Like, I didn't run into any of them that were, like, super challenging. But oftentimes it ends up just being, like, collect this from this part of the house. And usually it's where you just saw a ghost run into and you got to, like, actually go in there and deal with it. Or, you know, hide in the closet for a while. And, you know, but the kind of cool thing about that is that, you know, again, the actual backdrop looks really like, I mean, it's a bit of a misnomer to say, but it's a photorealistic style game. Like everything looks really realistic. It's not stylized to look like, you know, something cartoony or whatever.
No.
Or, you know, like macabre or whatever. It like looks like a dilapidated house. And but there is an item that you get. It's a special monocle that you can look through at any point, and it basically kind of gives you like an infrared vision for things that you're supposed to collect. So, you know, if you're trying to find something but you can't because it's like the same color as everything else, you know, it's the same level of dirty as everything else or whatnot, then throw on the monocle and, you know, it'll light up and then you'll be able to find it. So the game doesn't really try to be too difficult because it wants you to move from place to place so that it can scare the crap out of you as soon as you cross the invisible line.
Makes sense.
And that actually kind of makes it okay for me because, again, I'm not a jump scare fan. But the fact that, like, you know, when you're solving puzzles and when you're reading and when you're trying to do all this stuff, there's not, like, a timer until the monster comes and gets you. The monster has, like, it appears in specific places and in specific ways. And so, you know, if it kills you or whatever and then you have to replay a little section over again, it's going to behave in essentially the same way every time. So the game allows you to breathe, which is kind of cool, you know, because it is creepy, but it's not, you know, like panic levels through the roof constantly, which Remothered kind of had that a little bit. Remothered kept you tense because you're kind of, you know, in a perpetual like timer where, you know, if the one of the characters got, you know, the evil characters got too close to you, then, you know, they started to chase you and then that kind of interrupted what you were trying to do. And again, this game, like I said, allows you a little bit more space. But yeah, like I said, all the way down to like the game's about, I'd say, 2 to 3 hours long. It's not a very long game unless you're just really bad at puzzles. But the final like part of the game, which takes place in the attic, is so just like Remothered. I was like, I'm not going to say what happens, or I'm not going to spoil anything, but I am going to say that if you've played through Remothered and you go to the attic in this game, you're like, what the hell is this? I've done this already. But yeah, ultimately it's just all about, you know, getting into the story if you choose to get into the story, but mostly it's just about getting through this haunted house and having it, you know, scare the willies out of you occasionally.
Cool. So $25, your verdict?
$25, I think, is fair. Again, it's on the short side, but I think that the quality that went into the design and implementation of everything here makes it worth it. For folks who are looking for something more full-fledged, then I'd say it's a try it. But for people who really enjoyed the PT experience and they wanted that in, like, you know, something close to that, but in a full game, absolutely, this is for you.
Cool. All right, next is Manifold Garden, developed and published by William Cheer Studio, released October 20th on Steam for $19.99, also available on Xbox, PS4, and Switch. Rediscover gravity and explore Escheresque world of impossible architecture. Witness infinity in first person and master its rules to solve physics-defying puzzles. Cultivate a garden to open new paths forward where an eternal expanse awaits. Burnell, tell us about Manifold Garden.
Time to make up for what I just did with Ease 9. Let's go. So Manifold Garden is essentially a puzzle game where you can walk, you can run, and you can interact. That is literally all you can do. Well, correction, there's one other thing you can do. You can change your perspective in the form of, I guess, gravity. So, and that's really all you need for this game to be freaking astounding. You essentially go from wacky architectural structure to wacky architectural structure, and you are tasked with, well, progressing further. Like, that's literally the goal. And this is usually done in the form of switch puzzles, whether it might be, you know, pressing a button or placing a block onto a tile and opening a door and then progressing forward. And if that was what the game was and the only thing it was, this would be a very boring game, because those are very basic actions. However, the thing that this game does to take a basic premise and turn it into a holy crap, this is awesome premise, is you are able to, at the push of a button, change your perspective to avert gravity. So how do I describe this? Let's say you're in a room with four walls and you're walking along the floor and you decide you want to walk on the wall. Well, you walk up to the wall, press the button, the plane of gravity will shift, and now you're walking on the wall, and the former floor is now a wall, and everything shifts with it. This can be done in any room, anywhere in the game. It's bizarre. And some of those blocks I mentioned before where you have to place them, sometimes put them on a switch to make it activate, well, blocks will typically be situations where you can only pick up the block and move it if you're in the right plane of gravity. Otherwise, it's just stuck. So if you're not on the right plane of gravity, let's say I'm holding a block in my hand, right? And I decide to go up to the wall and invert gravity. Well, the block I was holding just kind of floats there where I was holding it, because it's just whatever. It doesn't move. It's just stuck in place. Now, if I go back, the block will fall to the floor because gravity's taking effect again on the block. And they make you do some really weird stuff with these mechanics to get a block to a place where it technically shouldn't be able to go. You'll be doing this a lot, and it may seem bland, but it's really not. And you will be scratching your head quite a bit trying to solve a number of these interactive puzzles. And another thing that's interesting about this game as far as how the puzzles work is I mentioned earlier how you go into different structures. Well, you're not always inside these structures. Sometimes you go outside, and when you're outside, what you see is a massive expanse of buildings that just ascend forever and descend forever. They don't stop. And you can just jump, if you want, into the abyss, and you'll fall, and you'll fall. And then if you didn't decide to move around at all, you might notice a familiar structure. It'll be the place you originally jumped from, because the world loops. So you can jump off of a building, just kind of float in space, maneuver yourself, and land on another building if you really feel like it. You can walk along the side of a building sometimes. There are some crazy things this game will do to mess with your head and make simple concepts into complicated concepts. I cannot stress enough how they take something so simple and it becomes something really complicated. And I love it. Love it very much. Architecturally, it's fantastic. It's beautiful. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the soundtrack is minimal. It's more about the atmosphere than like having cool jingles play as you do stuff. So don't come in here expecting to be bopping your head, but do expect to feel like, oh, how tranquil. This is nice. Yeah. Which is good. It fits the atmosphere of the game. And if there's a goal, I don't know what the hell it is. Sometimes you do stuff that seems like it's triggering after a lengthier effect. Maybe you're powering some great machine. Maybe you're actually activating, you know, the fourth dimensional fold, whatever. I don't know what your goal is in the grand scheme of things. But as far as your experience goes, you're solving puzzles with gravity. And it's a blast to do so. And a very wonderful feeling. Like, the puzzles don't really feel like there's any stress related to them because you can't die. There's no timer. There's nothing rushing you to accomplish anything. You just do what you want. And hopefully you succeed in the way on the process. I think it's a great game. I'm glad you recommended, you referred this to me on a whim, because I didn't expect what I got. And what I got was majesty. I wholeheartedly recommend this game to puzzle aficionado fans. What is it called? Manifold Garden.
Manifold Garden, $20, your verdict.
Buy the shit out of it.
Yay. Okay. I have it on Xbox, so I'm taken care of. I already own it. Mm. I did my part.
you committed.
Next game is called Crashlands, developed and published by Norg's favorite company, Butterscotch Shenanigans. Released January 29th on Xbox One for $14.99. Fight and tame alien beasts, craft resources into menacing weaponry, befriend the outlandish locals, and go toe-to-chin with a world-domineering maniac. Our friend Serlina wrote in a review. This is what she's got to say. Greetings, SML friends and fam. It's your girl Serlina, and this week I'm reviewing Crashlands for the Xbox One. Developed and published by Butterscotch Shenanigans, Crashlands is an action-adventure survival RPG that has you as Flex Davos, a space delivery driver who, through some mysterious or interesting shenanigans, gets stranded on a deserted planet and must craft her way off the planet and deliver her packages before she loses her Employee of the Month title streak and pension. Let's get on to the review. And yes, you read that right. Flux Davos' story is completely ridiculous. Flux is weird. Her faithful floating robotic companion Juice Box is weird. The cosmic space entity, whose name is not only unpronounceable but also quite unspellable, is also weird. The humor in this game is so over the top bad that it flips around and is good. I found myself chuckling at the jokes and then thinking about why I was laughing because the jokes are so horrible. The entire story is so corny, but it works. It's cute and I enjoyed it. Let's talk about the gameplay. No, I want to talk about the story. I love the story in this game. I love Butterscotch Shenanigans' humor. They also did Levelhead. It is hilarious. Their humor is amazing, and I'm so happy Crashlands came to Xbox. Anyway, she goes on. I will say that I have many, 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 many hours in survival games. I am fairly obsessed with a certain game whose company was just purchased by Tencent. As such, I am well-versed in the genre, and Crashlands fits well into it. It's not hard as some of the games I'm used to, but I don't mind that. It was a comfortable, relaxing romp, collecting things to craft things to make more things. This is where the game lulls you into complacency. See, once you're ready to actually fight some enemies, you'll quickly realize that if you aren't careful, they will literally crush you to smithereens. The first enemy you fight is a Wompit, and it's so cute. Looks like a little baby rhino, and you just want to pet it until it hits you and takes off an obscene amount of your health. Even with armor, I was stunned at how hard they hit. I immediately snapped back into hardcore survival mode to dispatch them. It's not hard to dispatch the enemies once you understand how they attack and what their weaknesses are. There's also something you can track in your data encyclopedia, which I liked. Any and everything you encounter, resources, monsters, etc., are kept here, and it gives you a little blurb about it. In the case of monsters, they'll tell you their resistances as well, so you can plan accordingly. The way inventory is handled in this game takes a bit of getting used to, but it's not terrible. You literally store everything in Flux's suit, and when she needs a specific item, it spawns immediately so you can use it. It's dark out. Once you've got it, the light source pops out, and you can see again. Need to chop down a tree? You can flawlessly use your axe and then transition to your sword to handle a baddie that's wandered into your line of sight. You can even go into your inventory and swap out different types of weapons. For example, the first weapon you build is a sword, but if that's not your style, you can use a hammer or an axe, and those play differently, but you don't lose your other weapons unless you salvage them yourself. It's like Flux is a never-ending bag of holding in that aspect. There's one major thing I did not like, and it's the fact that Flux moves very, very slowly. Oh, she happily prances along, and the animation is cute, but I just frustrated with the movement speed. This can be mitigated with crafting. Speed boosts are an attribute that can be attached to weapons, armor, and the like, but so far I haven't figured out how to do it with any intent. The attributes appear to be random, which is slightly annoying, but it's not a deal breaker for me. Crashlands is available right now on the Xbox One and other platforms for $15, and should you buy this one, you should definitely buy this one. If you're a hardcore crafty survival player or new to the genre, it's got more than enough to keep you satisfied. Not to mention that this game is a labor of love between three brothers. Their story really touched me, and I'm so glad that I got to review this game. Give Butterscotch Shenanigans some love, y'all. So there you go. I know Norg agrees with that. He covered the game a while ago, and he absolutely loved it, so... check out Crashlands, people.
Okay.
Yeah, you better. You better.
I have been genuinely curious about Crashlands for a while. I don't know what it is where I was like, I shouldn't. Maybe it was like something about it being like having a ridiculous amount that you can do in it. I don't know. But I've been eyeballing it for a while now, so this might be the trick.
Hey, and now it's on console. So
do it. He doesn't have time for it.
Throw it on your 4 for February list.
I give you something really interesting, little tidbit here. So over the course of the last 2 days leading into today, I've been noting every episode I've been on. And I came to realize that the very first episode I did of this show was on December 9th, 2016. It was episode 200 and what was that? 41.
Damn. All these years later and you're still here.
I know. It's all the drugs.
I know. I do what I can. I don't know. I think the crazier thing is next episode is our 8th anniversary.
Ooh.
Freaking wild.
Eight fucking years.
We all crack should get
a one to that.
It's not, it hasn't happened yet, Chris. It's next week.
Next episode. Mm. Not next week, next well, episode.
It's too late. It's already open.
Oh.
Our Thursday show.
The old one is cracked.
We're recording this on Tuesday. Technically, our anniversary is Wednesday, so tomorrow we turn 8.
Oh. Old enough to drink.
Old enough to drink.
Yes.
Yes. Eight years old. Old enough to get fucked up.
Oh, yeah.
Next game to talk about is called Rack in Ruin, developed by LifeSpark, published by Secret Item Games, released January 29th on Xbox One for $12.99. Rack in Ruin is a fusion of action RPG and bullet hell shooter, starring Rack, a demonic wizard with an appetite for destruction. Purnell, tell us about Rack in Ruin.
Rack in Ruin is a tried and true tradition of the SML podcast, where I get a game I've owned but never played. And then I get the game for review and end up playing it a lot. Because Rack and Ruin is a game I regret not playing sooner. This is a good game. But what the hell is it? Well, it is kind of, I want to say, Zelda-inspired in some ways in the way the game flows. You are Rack, tasked with taking over a planet, specifically because you have a tendency to destroy planets when your boss wants you to actually conquer them, so that he can have new slaves to lord over. So you're sent to this planet, told that you can't actually blow it up, but you can wreak havoc upon it. And wreak havoc you do, because your overall goal is to go to the different areas of the map, corrupt them, and turn them to the dark side, essentially. So go to a forest, you go to a central spawn energy point, corrupt the energy point with dark souls harvested from enemies that you killed throughout your play. The area becomes corrupted, and now it's not a forest anymore. Now it's a decaying swamp, complete with angrier, more vicious monsters, because that's what happens when you corrupt the terrain. Everything becomes meaner and hits harder, which is actually kind of funny, because that's your goal, and yet they don't give a crap about you. You're like, well, we're still going to try to fuck you up. And they actually cover that in the story. It's like, well, you can't really control evil people. They do what they want. Kind of like me and my boss. I don't give a crap what he wants from me either. It's like, exactly. So there you go. But so that's the main goal of the game. Of course, some small side bits come up later to kind of change the trajectory a bit. But that's your overall trajectory, your overall goal. But how the game plays is, as you walk around the maps, your main character fights by using various magic spells. So early on, you get a fireball spell, which doesn't cost any magic. You can just press the attack button and pew, pew, you're firing fireballs at enemies. And when you kill them, they usually drop items or souls, which are currency, and also which you use to corrupt points. In addition to fighting with your spells, more of what you obtain when you beat certain bosses or find certain treasures, but usually it's by beating like a boss or in getting a loot item after beating him. But also, you get a lot of different attack items, which are one-use items that when you use them, they might say, let you leave a trail of like slime behind you that hurts enemies, or it might allow you to summon an eyeball that floats around you and fires projectiles a la like an option from Gradius. And this is generally how the game works. You go to different areas, corrupt them, fight bosses, get more powerful and progress and proceed. But the game honestly is addictive. This is another case of game where I booted it up, started it thinking, just check it out a little bit and I'll come back to it later after I go to get dinner. And then I proceeded to play it for like 5 hours. I like this trend. I like playing games for longer than I expected. That's a good thing. That happened with this game too. It usually ends up becoming a matter of, like, I want to just one more area. I want to see what the next, magic spell is going to be, or I want to see if I can corrupt the next corrupted area is going to look like. Cause there's cool elements to like where you'll meet a person and he'll be like, hey, I need you to help me do this thing. And your character will respond with like, well, what's in it for me? I don't give a shit about you. And he's like, well, I won't bother you and you get access to this cool room, which might have powers hidden in it. Like, okay, well, now we're talking. It's win-win. I don't have to hear your voice anymore and I get something for it. So you'll end up doing stuff like that. Basically all the quests in the game are meant to hurt people or ultimately either benefit you or hurt someone else. Hell, one of the currencies in the game is the souls of villagers that died in the situation that you caused. And then you take their souls to a merchant, and you sell their souls to him for powered up attacks. Like, literally, you'll talk to the souls like, oh, woe is me, what's next? It's like, well, now you're going to get sold off to an old angry wizard man, so sucks to be you, Jimmy. And he just takes it and goes. And it's interesting because typically I don't like playing games where I'm the evil guy. I don't know what it is about me, but I just don't like being evil in my games. And yet, somehow in this game, it's still kind of fun. Like, I don't mind it so much. I really wish I didn't have to piss in the garden well, but you know what? Desperate times call for desperate measures. And quite frankly, I want more magical powers. So, ha-da-ta-da-ta. I genuinely find this game to be fun. Like, I didn't have any moments where I felt like, man, if only they did more of this, it'd be better. Maybe they did more of this, it'd be better. It honestly just kind of works, and it works well for me. Like, at most, I wish there were, like, more, I guess, like, dungeon-y items a la Zelda. Because, like, there are, like, actual dungeons in the game where when you go into it, it has the room-by-room breakdown. You can find keys hidden in certain areas, which may not even particularly be used in the dungeon itself. It's usually meant to open a door that may have like extra bonus treasures and stuff in it that you'll find. Like, oh, I'm glad I found this room, but it's not really required to open it. You'd just be glad you did. No. But you're going through the dungeons, beating enemies up, sometimes fighting a mid-boss, overall fighting a big boss, and then you move forward. But I also still enjoy it. You don't get a specific dungeon item again like Zelda, but eh. It didn't hurt it in the long run because you still get enough cool power-ups as you progress through the game. So, in the end, I find this game to be quite great. I wish I played it sooner, but at the end of the day, it makes for a better review because I get to play it for the first time now. And I think that other people would be happy to own it because I purchased it full price when it originally came out. And
you never played it.
And I never played it. It's the Purnell way, man! Doing reviews is like a way for me to actually play video games. It's a surprisingly effective method, but it works. And this game is a quality title. It deserves more attention from other gamers, hopefully that are better than me. Play your shit.
Carnage wants to know if you had any issues with the controls. He used the accessories app to remap it to play like a twin stick shooter because, what is it? The attack is on the face buttons, right?
From what I remember, I mean, I have to double think it, but the attack button was like the right bump, right trigger, and you used the right thumbstick to direct where your attack was going to go. Like, you don't have to walk in a direction that you want to fire in. I know that for a fact. But there were definitely times where I was like walking and kind of strafing backwards to shoot bullets at guys that were rushing at me. So maybe they just updated it for this version of the game.
Not too sure. But $13, what do you think?
I think it's worth buying. I think it's a good time.
Cool.
Just cool, cool, cool. You know, just let me know if you end up pissing any wells there within my vicinity.
Oh, I will piss in your well water every fucking day, Purnell. Don't you worry about that.
Well, no more water for me. It's all about dehydration.
All about Mountain Dew.
I'm drinking a Major Melon right now.
Oh, are you? I am drinking my last Mountain Dew Spark.
Hiya! See the Mountain Dew, bro.
Yeah, my Mountain Dew Spark. I only had four of them, but it was a good drink. It was fun while it lasted.
Now we've got to pick it and pick it at their base to say, give us more. Damn it. Give us some, actually, because you had to buy it from like overseas or some crap. So
I just bought it off eBay, not overseas.
Oh, it wasn't overseas. I've never even seen it before. So
it was like, only at Speedway.
When that explains that, we don't have Speedway.
Yeah, Raspberry Lemonade Mountain Dew, only at Speedway. They don't make it anymore. Drinking my last one. Doesn't matter, because we got one final game to talk about, and that's the game we started off with. Final game to discuss tonight is called Lost Caves, developed and published by Adam D. Smith, released January 29th on Steam, and is available for 99 cents until Friday when it jumps up to $3.99. Spelunk, Plunder, and Pickaxe in Lost Caves, a 2D collectathon all about exploration and treasure hunting. Venture through four expansive labyrinthine levels to find over 80 unique treasures to amass your wealth, and use your trusty pickaxe to defeat anything and everything in your way. Chris, how about you start off? What did you think of Lost Caves? Chris?
Yes, no!
Chris died.
Sorry, I was muted.
Oh, there you go.
My mic wasn't muted, but I had the Skype muted, and I didn't notice.
Yeah, that'll do it. Chris, tell us about Lost Caves.
You said Spelunk, but it sounded like you said Splunk, so now it's Splunk.
Hey, I did a remix project called Splunk.
Ooh.
Yeah, a Splunker from the NES.
I remember that, yeah. All right,
it was a joke project. It's pretty bad.
Awesome. I love bad projects.
I'll link it to you later.
But this isn't a bad project. This is a good game. It is it's funny because I'm like, it's hard for me to think of like things to say about it because we just had that long interview wherein like I think all the details that I wanted to go over like were gone over pretty thoroughly, including stuff that I didn't want to wasn't able to go over. But yeah, so I'll provide the recap.
Oh, we don't need to discuss the actual game itself. Just what did you think of it?
Oh, I really quite liked it. It was hard to believe. Well, I mean, apart from the soundtrack, I suppose, hard to believe that it was, you know, created by just one person. Because yeah, there's a lot of obvious care that went into it. And it's very fun. I think what I like about it is that it doesn't act like, you know, like we were talking about, it doesn't act like a Metroidvania, which a game like this very much could. Like, I was kind of getting, like, Elliot's Quest vibes from it because of the kind of minimal, pixelated style of it. But, you know, just the fact that you can go through these levels and, like, explore and not have to worry about finding the double jump and whatnot, you know, and that, like, you know, you're goal, you know, you can keep your eyes on the prize, as it were, and, you know, find all that treasure. And as Purnell had pointed out earlier as well, I really like that, that you actually have a treasure gauge that is just kind of subtly there, so that you know how much more you can collect in that stage. So yeah, and again, I had nothing but nice things to say about the soundtrack. I think it's a real good one. And yeah, it was like, I only found out today that it's a game that, like, right now only costs $1, and that was pretty surprising to me.
Yeah, so jump on that while it's still cheap. Cole, what were your thoughts on the game?
I liked it. I thought it's one of those that it's simple to pick up and play, but if you're actually going to get everything, you're going to have to spend some time with it. It kind of played on my shiny object syndrome because I kept trying to go after things that I couldn't. And I'm sitting there going, I want it, and I will sit here and die trying to get it. And, like, number one, standing over my shoulder going, you can't get that yet. And I was like, watch me. And then I just kept going after it. You shut
the fuck up. I'll get what I want.
So I appreciate that, you know, it kind of poked fun at the way that I play games in a way, because it just kept letting me fuck up.
It's good when games just let you fuck up.
Yeah. Like, it doesn't force you to go. If you don't want to go, if you just want to sit there and bang your head against the wall, it's like, go for it.
Yeah. Pernell, your thoughts on the game?
Hard damn game.
Okay. So, $4 on this one. What is everybody's verdict?
I think it's worth the $4, honestly, because even when I played it through, it was like, I think I pretty much got like a dollar an hour, so it was fun to me. I didn't stop playing until it was done. Worth it.
And I mean, you know, the only thing I would say, if the price is getting raised, and he was talking about adding, like, you know, different things and features and improvements and whatnot, the only thing I would, you know, tweak a little bit on this one is the frame rate, because it did, like, act a little choppy on me a few times, so.
I didn't have any problems with it. It hung right at 60 and 61 on mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can say I didn't have the problem like that, but the final, the boss that I mentioned on the thing, that is where I feel like I experienced, if there was anything related to frame rate issues, it would have been there, because that boss hits you with, you know, falling rocks, shaky screen, and you got to deal with all this simultaneously, and it's like, what am I missing? Something doesn't feel right. So that was probably frame rate, because I didn't know what else it was.
It sounds like some people got it, some people didn't, but anyway, that was such a minor thing. I mean, you know, it's otherwise, I have no complaints about this game whatsoever, so.
Well, I can agree with that. It's a really cool game. Buy it now while it's cheap. Get it Friday.
Or buy it when it's still expensive and support and support Adam.
buy it Friday when it's not as cheap, but it's still cheap, because $4 is still really cheap for this game.
Yeah. Or $4 is fine for this game.
Hold out for a year until Radleika brings it to console.
There you go. We're going to hook him up with Radleika. That's the power of this show. Radleika.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that is it for this episode. We made it through another one. Big thanks to all of you for being here, hanging out, keeping us company. Thanks to Surly for sending in her review. And thanks to Adam for being here. Again, the game is Lost Caves. It is on Steam. You could grab it now. Check the show notes for a link to Steam, and we'll get you over there, and you could buy the game. Music, I guess we're going to see what I could get off the SoundCloud page and play something from Lost Caves. Thanks. So, anyone have any final words to end the show?
Brush your teeth.
Wash your hands.
Get some sleep.
There you go, the healthy modules. Spill. 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 Come on now. Spill. Splunk. Yeah, that's right. Splunk. Splunk, 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 yeah, that's how you do it. Splunk. Splunk. Yeah. Splunk. Splunk, 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 shawty, it's your birthday. Splunk, 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 splunk,